AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentureTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, Doctor, Doctor, give me the news. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
So, I heard you guys had a movie scene that you wanted to talk about, but it's a movie I have not actually watched, so I don't know what you're talking about here. You're gonna have to tell everybody
Jonathan, it's an R-rated film.
That's why I wasn't able to get in.
Right. I know you're not allowed to go to those.
No.
It was the movie Prometheus, which I, like a lot of people, had some questions about.
It involved a lot of really shady plot lining.
I hear it was a beautiful film.
Oh, it was very pretty, and its vision of the relatively near future was really interesting in a number of ways, some of which are terrible, and some of which are genuinely fascinating.
There was one scene in particular that I thought might be kind of relevant to this show, and that scene is a horrifying kind of body violation scene featuring a dramatic surgery performed spur of the moment, kind of.
Entirely by a robot.
Right, not by a human at all.
It's automated.
So one of the characters...
Those, surgery pod things I've heard about, right?
Right, yeah. The character hops into a big glass coffin and then some knives pop out and start doing their thing.
So I guess this leads us into a discussion about robotic surgery and
how
that's a real thing, but not necessarily a real horror show thing like what you have just briefly described.
Right.
No, one would hope that in real life, robotic surgery is not quite so scary and is in fact a good thing, though I guess we can debate that as it comes up.
Sure. Now, this is not a new idea. It's not that robotic surgery has debuted in the last year or two. It's actually been around for a while. In fact, the first documented case I could find was a case back in 1985, and it was using a surgical arm called the Puma 560, used during a neurological biopsy. Now, this particular in this particular case, the robot, as I understand it, was not performing the surgery, but was being used in conjunction with this biopsy. As the years went on, you started to see more and more use of robots because people were, well, like engineers and doctors, were saying there was a lot of potential there. Other doctors were very hesitant because we're talking about very delicate procedures. This is, in many cases, a life or death situation, and you don't want to take any liberties with that kind of thing, obviously. But over the next couple of years, they started using them in other procedures, robotic arms, that is, for laparoscopic procedures, for example, which usually means there's some you're using a flexible optic camera as well for minimally invasive surgery in order to be able to handle things inside the body without having to make a huge open cut.
Right, and laparoscopic procedures can be performed by hand.
Sure.
I want to make clear that's not something that's necessarily unique to robots. So there are a lot of surgeons who have trained in this art of trying to make small incisions in the body and stick in their instruments and sort of do what they need to do in there without making big open cuts.
Right.
But, of course, there are limitations to what you can do by hand in that sense, and we can talk about that more in a minute.
Sure. And then we had other robots, including one called RoboDoc, which is probably my favorite name. It was the first robot approved by the FDA, and they also approved the ESOP robotic system for endoscopic surgeries back in 1990. The ESOP led into another development. There was another robot called Zeus, which followed ESOP. And after Zeus, the work that went into ESOP and Zeus later informed engineers who built the Da Vinci systems, which are probably the best known robotic surgery tools out there right now. They're the ones that if you read a story about robotic surgery, 9 times out of 10, it's a Da Vinci system that they're talking about.
Sure. They were finally approved for FDA use in the year 2000.
Yep. And we've even seen some transcontinental surgeries performed using robots, because one of the other things we'll talk about is that using a robot assistant, essentially, or a robot, you know, think of the robot as a replacement for the surgeon's actual hands, means that the surgeon could potentially perform that surgery while not even being present within the room.
Yeah.
They could be, like in this case, on the other side of a continent. So that's kind of exciting. So we're going to talk about all of that, but we should also mention that it's not this using robots in surgery is not something that was immediately embraced, and still to this day, it is a controversial subject. It's one of those that has there are a lot of both advantages and disadvantages, and you have to weigh them very heavily before you can say outright, is it a good or bad thing? Especially, you know, it may be particular case to case basis. But a 2004 report in the Annals of Surgery urged caution and skepticism about robotic surgery, saying that, this is a direct quote, "Robotic surgery is a new and exciting emerging technology that is taking the surgical profession by storm. Up to this point, however, the race to acquire and incorporate this emerging technology has primarily been driven by the market. In addition, surgical robots have become the entry fee for centers wanting to be known for excellence in minimally invasive surgery, despite the current lack of practical applications. Therefore, robotic devices seem to have more of a marketing role than a practical role. Whether or not robotic devices will grow into a more practical role remains to be seen." And in fact, the report went on to suggest that it's possible that by the time robot surgery would be practical enough for it to be universally adopted, something better would come along, which is, you know, another thing to consider.
Yeah, well, one thing this brings up, the first thing I would say to note is that that was from 2004, and
yep,
things have come a long way since then. But the other thing to note, I think, is that it's pretty much inarguable that in the future, robotic surgery will offer big benefits. So the big questions are, does it currently offer big benefits now? And I think that's where most of the controversy lies.
Well, and like I said, there is also that possibility that by the time robotic surgery can demonstrably show that it is beneficial, that something else comes along by that point. But I expect that there are going to be at least a few surgical procedures that will still benefit from robotic surgery, even if something else comes along. I can't see, and granted, this might just be short-sightedness on my part, but I can't see some magical technique sweep in and revolutionize surgery across the board to the point where the robotic surgery progress we see right now ends up being futile.
Well, nanobots.
Right. There's which the magical robotic nano healing fog. Well, that brings up a good point, actually, which is something that I want to clarify before we move on. We keep saying robotic surgery, and that's often the term people use when they're talking about these existing systems. But if you have in mind the definition of a robot, one thing that should be pretty central to that is autonomy.
Well,
something that,
that's often the case.
Yeah.
I think for a lot of us, when we hear the word robot, we think of some form of autonomous being that is capable of following instructions from a human, but is able to do so on its own. It doesn't have to necessarily have human oversight or control every step of the way. Now, that's not the case with all robots, but it's the ones like when we think of manufacturing robots, they're automated, right? It's not someone who's actually moving levers so that a giant arm is going to weld a car door onto a frame. That's not how that works. It's all automated. That's not necessarily the case with surgery.
With surgery, what we're generally talking about is what should probably be called robot-assisted surgery, at least for today, meaning that what happens when you go in for robot surgery is a surgeon sits down, a human surgeon sits down at a terminal and controls a device that cuts you and does all kinds of wonderful things inside your body.
That was such a magical description. yeah. So usually you have a combination of things. In fact, you really do need a combination of things, including you have to have some sort of camera view inside the patient, usually. So you have a monitor that gives you a view of what you're doing. From what I understand, using these monitors is incredibly challenging for people. And the reason for that is that, one, your actions may be in reverse to what you're seeing on the monitor, right? It's not like a mirror where if you move right, the instrument moves right. If you're doing this by hand. So let's say that you have you're using tools that are inside the patient. There's a camera inside the patient. You're watching a monitor and you are moving based upon what you see there. So if you move the instrument right, you may see in the monitor that the instrument's moving left. So that can be very confusing. It can be difficult to coordinate your hand-eye coordination so that you don't cause any problems.
It requires practice, like anyone who's had to change the button configuration on their Xbox. It's like that, but times a million and with a person.
Right.
So,
and then you also have the issues of you might not have the right kind of haptic feedback while you're working within the patient. So it's harder for you to judge if you are cutting into healthy tissue or if you're cutting into anything at all, especially if you don't want to be cutting into something. There's also the challenge of the fact that you're working within a three-dimensional environment, a patient's body, and you're looking at it on a two-dimensional screen. These are all challenges that we humans have to overcome in order to be able to do this successfully. And of course, there are some surgeons out there who are really, really good at it. But the idea was that maybe with robots and offloading some of that control over to an automated system, well, not maybe automated, but a robotic system, could minimize some of those challenges, or at least make them easier to overcome.
Certainly, and some co-developing technologies are making this easier. For example, we have the ability to put stereoscopic cameras inside patients these days and create an on-the-spot 3D model of what's going on. So that kind of thing can vastly improve the experience of the doctor and the patient who are going through this kind of surgery.
Another thing that's developing is the idea of the force feedback. Right?
Yeah.
That you can, with these robotic systems, the controls you have in your hand have the potential to give you resistance so that you feel as if you're actually cutting.
Right. So you can also, from some of these systems, have in barriers so that once you reach a certain level, like if you have designated certain tissue as being healthy and your robotic instrument is getting closer and closer to cutting into that, you start encountering more resistance, which essentially tells you to back off.
Until the point at which, some of these robots will actually stop if they hit one of these barriers that you have defined to make sure that they will not cut open something that they're not supposed to.
Right. So in this case, it requires that you have to define these areas. It's not that the robot automatically necessarily knows that something is healthy tissue versus not healthy. Although we're seeing some other technologies come out that are pretty cool that could aid in that, where if you were to pair those technologies with the robotic systems, we could eventually get to a point where we have robotic tools that can, on the fly, determine whether or not the tissue you're working with is healthy or diseased.
Are you talking about the vaporizing eye knife?
Absolutely.
That's a cool thing. Different technology, yeah. Not robotic, but very cool for surgery. The idea is you're cutting on, say you're trying to excise a tumor. This is a knife that it burns the tissue as it's cutting it and then sniffs the smoke to tell if the place you're cutting is cancerous or not. And
right.
That allows you to know it almost instantly where the margin should be.
So you could understand, I mean, you could easily imagine a robotic system that incorporates some sort of technology similar to that and being able to aid a doctor, even if you're not able to ahead of time determine exactly what zones are good zones versus bad zones. So, we're talking a lot about, we'll talk mostly about the Da Vinci line, I think, because again, that's probably the most popular, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
It's built, like I said, upon the success of previous projects like Aesop and Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
It's one that you can, you know, if you hear about robotic surgery, it tends to be the systems that pops up. I mean, occasionally you might run into some of the older ones, but this is the one that I think is considered the state of the art these days.
Yeah, I was wondering, well, what kind of procedures are done with robot-assisted surgeries these days? I think a big one is prostate surgery.
Yeah, that's the one. A lot of the studies have been around prostate surgery in particular.
In fact, I've read several statements that it's basically becoming the norm in prostate surgery. Like these days, you're just likely to get a robot-assisted procedure if you go in for a prostatectomy.
Yeah, this is one of those deals where it's been shown to be an effective means of performing surgery. In fact, we'll talk a little bit later about a study that specifically looked at cases of people who underwent prostate surgery and had the ones that had robotic assisted prostate surgery versus the ones that were going to just strictly human surgeons. And it's an interesting result, actually very promising for the future of robotic surgery in general. But beyond that, I've also seen that it's being used for things like coronary artery bypasses, gallbladder removal, hip replacement, kidney removal or transplants, hysterectomies, and more, although not necessarily with the same success rate as prostate surgery.
Right. There are questions about all these. But I think before that, we should talk about what at least are the proposed advantages that a robotic system could provide over a standard open surgery or a handheld laparoscopic surgery.
Well, as finely tuned as surgeons' hands are, as you were saying before, I think, Joe, robots can operate at a much smaller and more delicate level than even the very best human surgeon. So you therefore have the opportunity to make your surgeries minimally invasive. And that just basically means having smaller incisions. In some cases for heart surgeries, not having to crack the breastbone, which is a terrific boon, you can imagine.
Right. Well, there are actually two aspects to that. One, I guess, is the whole minimally invasive approach. And the other is just the scaling down of movement in general, which no matter what situation you're in, it does give you an advantage as a surgeon to imagine, say, you want to move your hand 1 centimeter, but that translates to, I don't know, a much smaller measure of the actual tool moving, maybe 1 millimeter.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you can design. In fact, these robot systems are designed so that they can translate human movements into much smaller, it scales it down so much that you can make very, very precise movements that would be difficult for even the most skilled surgeons. Going on with that minimally invasive, there are a lot of benefits to that, right? I mean, apart from just the fact that you already mentioned one with heart surgery, I mean, not having to crack the breastbone is huge. The fact that any time you're going to have minimally invasive, if that's the way it goes, you're going to have smaller incisions, so you heal faster. There's a much lower risk of infection. It tends to be people have reported having better quality of life after that kind of surgery.
It's less trauma to the body, and that overall, especially in the case of someone who needs surgery for anything, is probably going to be pretty important.
Right. And again, like we said, minimally invasive doesn't necessarily mean that it was robotic surgery. A human can do these sort of procedures too, but robots can do them at a degree that we just can't.
Right. The idea is that you can go further and further down that rabbit hole of being minimally invasive, even to the point of perhaps just having single incision surgeries. I saw a cool TED talk with a person named Catherine Moore, and she was talking about a prototype of a surgical robot that would be a single incision surgical robot. So it inserts, say, just a single tube into the patient through a single incision, mm-hmm. and out of that tube comes your camera and several telescoping surgical instruments. So you don't even have to come in from multiple directions.
That would be pretty incredible, yeah. So the benefits there are pretty easy to understand. The idea that you heal faster, that you have much lower risk of infection. I mean, that's huge important news. The precision is also really important because, again, you can end up having a surgical procedure where you get the specific outcome that you desire with as few side effects as possible, right?
Right. And you can also, with the precision, factor in things like a robotic control system for your hand. So imagine that, well, you don't have to imagine, you probably know from experience that human hands are not perfectly steady. You know, right. Even somebody with a surgeon's hands might have slight tremors in their movement.
Especially after you've been doing a surgery for some 7 or 8 hours.
Oh, yeah.
Exhaustion can absolutely set in.
These procedures are not necessarily quick.
Right. Yeah. So what if you have a machine that is able to detect unintended tremors in your movement and filter those out? Well, right. In fact, that's something that Da Vinci claims to do with their system.
So in other words, the movements that the surgeon makes consciously are the only ones that get translated into actual surgical procedures. Anything that was an unconscious movement is filtered out, and thus you don't end up negatively impacting the patient.
Right. So there have been a lot of questions about whether robot-assisted surgery offers any, like, measurable net benefit to the patient today.
Right, because as it turns out, one of the things we'll talk more about a little bit later, these systems are really, really expensive.
Yeah.
So to justify the expense, you have to say, well, what's the actual benefit? Is there a benefit?
Well, we mentioned prostate cancer, that robotic surgery is kind of the norm for prostate cancer these days. I think that's the only one that's been proven by scientific study to have an advantage.
I don't know if it's the only one. It's the only one I've seen.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, to be fair, robotic surgery is still, even though it started back in 1985, it's still relatively young, and it's hard to do studies to show continued success because you don't have a very large pool of patients to look at.
Right. It's a relatively small sample size.
Right. So. And very few of them have had robotic surgery long enough ago for you to say, look, at 5 years, the success rate was blah, blah, blah. At 10 years, we don't have enough of a size there, but we have had some studies.
Right. The one I wanted to talk about that you just mentioned, Lauren, was the one about prostate surgery. It was a UCLA study. It was published in February in the journal European Urology, and it found that prostate cancer surgery is performed by robotically assisted surgeons as opposed to the traditional open procedures. Have a superior success rate, like measurably. They measured the cancer margins in excised tissue from these removed prostates, and the robotic surgery was, quote, associated with 5% fewer positive margins. So that was 13.6% versus 18.3%. And in a cancer surgery, you don't want positive margins.
Right.
You want the thing removed. Positive margins means that there was cancer at the edge of the thing they took out.
Which suggests that there could still be cancer cells left within the patient.
Right.
Right. And so what's more, the patients who had the robotic surgery in these in this study had a 1/3 reduction in the likelihood of needing to get another therapy for their cancer within the next 2 years.
For cancer patients, that's huge news too. I mean, obviously managing cancer is a life altering experience. Mm-hmm. And, so any patient who would have that kind of, benefit, I mean, it's kind of hard to, I don't know that you can overstate how beneficial that is. So another potential advantage we talked about briefly a little bit earlier was the ability to perform surgery. A doctor could perform surgery even if that doctor is nowhere near the patient using robotics, using a telesurgery, right? The idea of telepresence where the doctor's presence is pretty much taken up by this robot that's following the doctor's commands.
Mm-hmm, right. And that can be terrific for many different situations. If you've got an expert in a certain kind of surgery, but he or she cannot be in the physical location or cannot be there quickly enough to perform surgery, then yay.
Yeah, this is one of those things I often hear about for cases where you have people, like, say, in a scientific research center in a really remote location, like, I don't know, Antarctica. And you may or may not have someone at that center who has the training and ability to perform particular medical procedures. But if you had one of these robots and the ability to connect with someone who does have that expertise, you could still have that performed. You know, you might be in a place, and you know, Antarctica obviously is an extreme example, but it's also but it's also one that's realistic.
Yeah.
Because there are scientific research centers in Antarctica, and it's not easy to get people in and out of them.
Right. Well, you can't always predict when you're going to need a complicated surgery. I mean, what if you're down there and suddenly you need an appendectomy?
Right. And
that has to happen fast.
And if you don't, you know, if you don't have the means of getting someone to come and grab them by air and lift them out, if you know, that's just not an option, then you really are limited. So these are, there are definitely cases in extreme circumstances where this would be really, really useful.
Right. And though we have seen that tested before, telesurgery is more thought of, I think, as a potential future benefit than as a really current benefit.
Yeah, yeah. There's some big challenges there, too.
As of right now, the latency issue, even though we are getting faster and faster computers and internet connections, it's still not quite quickly enough that I would personally want someone performing robotic surgery from across the country, and certainly not from like Antarctica.
Right. So latency, just in case you guys don't know, that's essentially the delay between when you take an action and when that action is carried out by whatever electronic device you're using.
Right. So it's really frustrating when you're like playing a shooter game online. It could be deadly if you're like cutting somebody.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's one of those things that we have to get better and better at delivering high speed access. And that's, we're starting to see that happen. But yeah, like you said, Lauren, it's one of those things that is kind of delaying telesurgery from being a common practice in the present.
Though one interesting way around that could be the development of more autonomy in the surgical robots themselves, where you've got robots that are well trained enough that they can do the precision activity on their own with merely kind of a supervising human surgeon on the other end who doesn't have to do each individual cut with his or her hand.
We'll talk more about autonomy and the challenges there, too. And then we have one other benefit here that I see, the idea that robots can take our jobs.
Yeah, no, that's a great thing. Honestly, it is. I mean, surgery requires multiple staff members to be on hand, sometimes working, as I said before, for very long hours under really high degrees of concentration, which can lead to a lot of fatigue and, honestly, medical problems for those surgical staffers themselves. Automation could really allow for needing, you know, fewer surgeons and nurses on hand, thus reducing their workload and reducing their personal fatigue. And could also increase the number of surgeons capable of performing certain complex surgeries. It could overall potentially reduce the cost of surgeries due to, you know, needing fewer staff members on hand. But hey, let's talk about that wacky cost thing, because that's kind of a big issue.
Well, I was going to say, because I agree that that is a potential benefit for the future, but as of now, these kinds of systems are more labor intensive and cost more.
Right.
So yes, it's no secret that robotic surgery is mega expensive. So of course, you know, they're going to negotiate prices, but to get a ballpark idea, there was a 2008 New York Times article that reported Da Vinci systems were selling for an average of $1.3 million a piece up front. That was, and so you take that and then you add on hundreds of thousands more dollars in service upgrades and components that you have to replace after every surgery, or at least very frequently.
Right, but they got to be cheaper now, right? I mean, because that was back in 2008. So today they have to be cheaper, right?
Nope.
Yeah.
What?
A piece that was published from the Wall Street Journal just today. We are recording this, by the way, on April 1st, 2014. So this is not an April Fool's joke. But yeah, they reported that the current range for Da Vinci systems is some $1.85 million to $2.3 million.
I don't know if those numbers may include some of those other extra costs I was talking about rolled in.
That's a possibility. It did not give me specific details.
It didn't break it down.
But so robotic procedures in general are more costly than traditional surgeries. Just one example, there was a study published in JAMA in 2013 And it tried to compare costs for one specific procedure. So it was just looking at robotically assisted hysterectomies versus laparoscopic hysterectomies, the traditional, you know, laparoscopic done by hand, among women with benign gynecologic disease. That was the title. And the study found that the robotically assisted surgeries and the laparoscopic hysterectomies had similar morbidity rates, but the robots were more costly. So the outcomes were comparable, but the robot procedures were just more expensive. On average, the total costs of a robotically assisted procedure were $2,189 more than for a laparoscopic procedure.
Right. So we're starting to see kind of those criticisms that were brought up in that 2004 report are still, at least in some cases, possibly valid. I mean, the idea that a robotic assisted procedure may come across as more of a marketing tool than a practical tool in the current state of the way the technology fares right now.
Right. There's this idea among some surgeons that there's this possible illusion of advantage caused by the dazzling technology of a robotic surgeon. So some surgeons have alleged that patients seem to want robotic procedures, even if the patients are told that they cost more and there's no evidence in this particular case that they're better than the old surgery. It's just like they seem to see the option of a robot and think, wow, that looks really high tech. It must be the best. And so they want to go with it, even if it's not necessarily the best, if it's just as good but costs a lot more.
Right.
So that would be a problem.
Mm-hmm. On top of that, the other issue, or another issue, I should say, is that these systems are not small. We're not talking about a robotic arm that fits on a little side table and you just lay it down next to the patient.
It's not like Inspector Gadget's backpack.
No, we haven't reached that level yet either. Yeah, these are big, big systems, which means they take up a lot of room. So you have to have the space to house them and be able to move them around. And when you add that to the cost, so we're talking about the cost of purchasing, maintaining, housing this thing, being able to move it around the facility, this means that it creates a really big barrier for a lot of medical centers and they have to make a tough decision. Do they go and invest in getting one of these things and making sure that their facility can handle it? Spending all that money, knowing that at least for some procedures, there is not a scientifically measurable benefit to having that versus the traditional procedures. Do they go ahead and do that anyway? By doing that, they know that they're not going to be able to use that same money for something else. And this is a big issue. A lot of medical centers feel pressured to go into getting these robotic surgery systems because, again, there's this perception that the newest is the best. And therefore, if they don't have it,
in order to be considered a good center,
right,
then they're going to need this.
Exactly. Right. If they don't have it, then they're not obviously not a cutting edge medical center. So it's kind of this rough place right now. Now, that's not to say that robotic surgery isn't going to continue to improve. I fully believe that we're going to see it.
Oh, sure. I mean, robotics overall as a field is improving probably every day,
let alone
every year.
It's pretty incredible.
It got worse yesterday, but it got twice as better today.
Yeah.
So it's averaging out.
Yeah, we just say that the line is on a constant incline. I mean, you see some dips here and there, but, you know, the trend is there.
Well, speaking of that, it's not like these machines are insusceptible to things like recalls, like any other bit of machinery. There was a Class 2 recall of Da Vinci Model C robots in 2013 because a friction issue was causing some robots to freeze up during surgeries. It was determined that probably these machines weren't being tested entirely properly before leaving the factory, which was causing these small malfunctions. It is a small recall. In a Class 2 recall, a product could cause temporary or medically reversible problems in a patient. So it's a voluntary thing, and the device doesn't need to be taken off the market. But, you know, I just wanted to say, like, that kind of stuff does happen.
Right. Sure. Well, there have been people who have actually criticized robotic surgical procedures for being, they think, dangerous, or there are legitimate safety questions.
Right. They may not always be reliable, right?
Yeah, in a small anonymous survey of 176 doctors, some 57% of surgeons who had used a Da Vinci machine for prostate surgery said that they had experienced an irrecoverable intraoperative malfunction either before or during a surgery, which I'm not positive about the definition of that, but I'm pretty sure it's like a surgical blue screen of death.
Yeah, yeah, that's a Ooh. Phrase you don't want to hear during any kind of medical procedure is blue screen of death.
Absolutely not. And okay, so surgeries always come with a certain amount of risk. You are never
right.
going to be completely safe when people are cutting you open and doing stuff to your insides.
Sure.
Or just undergoing general anesthesia.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There are any number of wacky things that can go wrong with our bodies at any given moment, let alone when we're in a hospital, which was probably the cheeriest thing I've ever said on this show. But sorry, guys, them's the facts. We're weird meat machines.
Yep.
Furthermore, the underreporting of things going wrong during surgeries to the FDA is widely accepted to be an issue. I mean, not just in robotic surgery,
right.
in any kind of surgery.
Across the medical industry in general.
Mm-hmm. However, researchers at Johns Hopkins did a study of the Da Vinci surgeries that had taken place between the year 2000 and 2012 and found evidence that adverse events related to these devices may be, and I quote, vastly underreported.
Hmm.
And in fact, in 2013, a question was officially raised by the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists about the usefulness of robotic hysterectomy procedures. So some 1 in 9 women will undergo a hysterectomy at some point in her life. And it's also the type of robotic surgery that's apparently the most likely to cause a patient harm. Some 43% of patient injuries that have been reported were during this type of surgery, in fact. Mm. So, you know, they also went into everything else that we've talked about with cost and all of that. But this surgical procedure in particular might have been one that was adopted too widely too soon.
Right.
Yeah, you see that over and over. The idea from the critics of robotic surgery, they're criticizing not so much the idea in theory, but just as it's practiced
the
now, that we're rolling it out too fast.
Yeah,
and
so
the marketing is too aggressive.
With the prostate removal surgeries, I would say that using robotic surgery in general has been rolled out pretty quickly across a lot of different surgical procedures. With the prostate removal surgery, as that study from UCLA found out, it actually looks like there's a demonstrable benefit there. And that's fantastic. Whether or not that was rolled out too quickly in that surgery, I don't know, but it does look like there, it is definitely beneficial to have the robotic assisted surgery. But in other cases, we may not be there yet. It doesn't mean we won't get there. It just means that the implementation we have right now may not be ideal. In fact, it may not even be anything wrong with the technology. It may be that surgeons are still learning how to use it at its most effective way. So there may be some cases where I wouldn't call it human failure so much as we haven't figured out how to leverage the technology in the way that's most beneficial.
Right. Well, one thing that would obviously be a big benefit in the future would be the idea of autonomous surgery, like truly autonomous robotic surgery.
Well, unless you tick off your autonomous robotic surgeon. In which case, you know, you got Terminator all over the place.
That actually kind of also comes into play in Prometheus, because it occurred to me that the ship's doctor is the android character. So you're technically dealing with all robot surgery all the time on that ship, and
it's
not all
great.
Of it goes well.
Okay,
yeah.
So well, here's the thing about autonomous autonomous robotic surgery is, I think it's a really interesting idea. I think it's going to be one of the most challenging applications for any sort of autonomous robot. First of all, we're really far out from having autonomous robots that could do something as delicate as a surgical procedure.
Delicate and important.
Yeah, without human interaction, without a human controlling it. And the reason why I say that is because not only are we talking about life or death procedures, but we're also talking about the human body, which does not come in one shape and size. Right. There is a lot of variation there. Even with a simple, quote unquote, simple surgical procedure, you can have a lot of complications that can crop up. And robots have to be able to detect and adapt.
Yeah.
Exactly. Just the way a human would. And that's hard to do.
But that does raise the question of how would you do this? How would you program a robot to autonomously perform a surgical procedure. And I think one of the things that would be really crucial to this would be a learning robot.
Yeah.
So perhaps a robot that would be connected to the human controlled system. So it studies what the human surgeons do. Maybe you give it 10,000 surgeries to analyze. You select your 10,000 best variations of this same surgery and say, learn from these.
Honestly, I would imagine that it would have to involve a lot of work with human cadavers, too.
Yeah,
sure,
I mean,
sure.
You would have to. I had an opportunity to talk with some robotics experts recently, and then they were showing me robots that do learn, and they learn by you showing them that you want them to do certain tasks in a certain order. And if they make a mistake, you can correct them so that they learn that, all right, that was an exception to what I'm supposed to do. I won't do that again. And then once they learn the procedure, they'll repeat it exactly over and over and over again. However, that's also a procedure that involves a uniform material that doesn't change from case to case. So it's
right.
different from surgery.
Yeah. So you're going to need to, I mean, A, just like a human surgeon, have a lot of practice on things what can't be hurt.
Yeah.
Be those models or cadavers. And B, incorporate a whole lot of sensory technology, like the most advanced Roomba you have ever met in your life, that is able to tell from the inside of you what its surroundings are.
There is a lot of potential there for it to really revolutionize the way we think about medicine. I mean, right now, medicine is a thing you go to.
Right.
Right. You go to the hospital, you go to the doctor. But if you could have, say, a really versatile general robotic surgeon that's small enough to fit in a backpack, I mean, that what a bizarre world that would be. You could carry around a limitless supply of medical treatment with you where you go.
I would let myself get critically injured all the time.
As opposed to it just happening accidentally. Now,
right.
Now you're inviting it.
Yeah.
Well, you can see how that would make a big difference for, say, people who are in any kind of exploring capacity.
Right.
So you're exploring space or you're exploring a remote wilderness.
Or a military capacity.
Yeah,
obviously.
There you go.
So things mm-hmm. like triage on the battlefield. See, now I'm thinking that the quote I should have used should have been a movie quote. I should have said, pain don't hurt, because I didn't realize that was Lauren's philosophy. This would be pretty phenomenal. And these are advances that we do think are quite a ways down the road. We don't want anyone to go away from this episode thinking, oh, you know, within like a year or two, we're going to have these incredible robots.
Backpack surgeons. No,
these are enormous challenges. And not that they are challenges that we'll never overcome. It's just going to take a lot of work. I expect that there will be such a thing. Whether I see it in my lifetime or not, I don't know. But I certainly hope to see extreme advances in this field. I think it could be incredibly beneficial. One of the other interesting things, and we didn't really cover this earlier on, is robotic surgery is one of those fields where there seems to be another issue with cost, in that generally speaking, with electronics, we think the longer something's been around, the less expensive it tends to be, because we improve on manufacturing processes. Materials become cheaper, we streamline everything, and so therefore you end up saving money down the road. The one criticism I've seen about robotic surgery says that at least in these stages, that's probably not going to be true, because while we perfect means of creating robotic surgery tools from that were state-of-the-art like 3 years ago, we're continuously improving all the other technologies that you would want to include with the current generation of robotic surgeons, thus keeping that price either steady or climbing for the near future.
Oh, sure. And medical research alone, I mean, the capacity to test all of this is very expensive.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's not going to get cheaper ever.
Right, right. Unless we can suddenly start cloning beings and have absolutely no ethical issues with it. That probably will come after we have robotic surgeons.
Jonathan, why do you have to end every podcast with the idea of cutting up clones?
Everybody needs a hobby. And on that note, if you guys have any suggestions for future episodes of Forward Thinking, let us know. Send us an email. Our address is fwthinking@discovery.com. Or drop us a line on Twitter, Facebook, Google+. We are at all three of those with the handle FW Thinking, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Johnny B. Goode, the host of the podcast Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon. This podcast dives deep into the story of Ray Trapani and his company, CentraTech. I'll explore how 320-somethings built a company out of lies, deceit, and greed.
I've been saying since a very young age that I was going to be a millionaire. If someone's like, oh, what's your best way of making money? I'm like, oh, we should start some sort of scheme.
Listen to Creating a Con, the Story of BitCon on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My simple solution to the problem was remove people from the scene and help them feel safer.
In response to attacks against Asian Americans, Maddie Park raised over $250,000 to donate cab rides to the Asian community.
There is so much more work to be done. We really need to come together and tackle this issue as a community.
Support the Asian community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. Welcome to Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. This week, I'm talking to the one and only Ryan Seacrest.
Love the connection to people. I think at the core, what I get excited about, what gets me up in the morning, is connecting with people in an unscripted, unvarnished way. It's getting to say something to them, hear back from them, know that I'm part of the routine. And I look forward to getting on the air. I look forward to it.
In these exciting times, we're looking to the math, the strategy and analytics, and the magic, the creative spark, more than ever. Listen to Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.